Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. For today, we're talking about liver disease, specifically fatty liver disease, which is the predominant type of liver disease that affects Americans. We can talk a little bit about viral liver disease, because there's a lot of hepatitis B and C as well. Our guest is an expert on this subject. She's an expert on a lot of subjects. She's a naturopathic physician, Dr. Lynn Patrick. And Lynn is the founder of ProgressiveMedicalEducation.com, which is a great resource for people who want to learn more about complementary and alternative medicine, integrative approaches. She has her own practice, which is the Wellness Integrative Naturopathic Center in Durango, Colorado. And so, Lynn, in part one, we ran down some of the many contributing factors to liver disease. Let's talk solutions now. What are some of, well, first of all, from the standpoint of diet, what is the ideal diet if you've got fatty liver?
Well, interestingly enough, there's actually been research in this area. And in 2007, there was a meta-analysis on this published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And they took a look at all the studies that had ever been published on different diets, like the Zone diet, the DASH diet, the South Beach diet, the Weight Watchers diet, the American Diabetes Association diet. And they looked at whether those diets actually resulted in decreases in liver enzymes and improvement in metabolic syndrome. And fascinating, what they found was that the only diet that was able to achieve that was the Mediterranean diet. Mm. And in study after study, the Mediterranean diet significantly improved non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and improved metabolic syndrome. What was interesting to me was that the Atkins diet actually increased steatosis in people who had fatty liver.
Okay, well, wait, let's pause on that. That's very important. So in other words, cutting carbs completely, okay, you may solve part of the problem because you're not getting any of the sugars that contribute to fat deposition, but really larding it on with a high saturated fat diet, also not desirable for this condition.
That is correct, and I'll tell you why. I've been fascinated with this, right? Because I don't necessarily think that a high protein, high meat diet is bad for you.
Mm-hmm. But
in general, for someone without liver disease. But what we know is that without the proper antioxidants in fruits and vegetables, without the fiber that those foods provide, we can't have a healthy microbiome. And without a healthy microbiome, you can't reverse fatty liver disease. And so I think that, you know, certainly the Mediterranean diet is effective for a number of reasons. The polyphenolic compounds, the antioxidant compounds in olive oil, the antioxidant compounds in EPA, or the effect of EPA and DHA, fish oil in fish, the fiber in nuts and whole grains. And we can get into a conversation about grains too, I know, but it's fascinating to me that, you know, this was a very comprehensive meta-analysis. And I think that the Mediterranean diet, because of those really important medicinal qualities of certain components, is preferable in fatty liver disease. The other glaring omission, if you look at the true Mediterranean style diet, which is the,
I think I know what's coming here. Yeah, it's all that. Yeah, that's the main source of resveratrol in that diet is red wine.
Right, but what's omitted and what you never see in the Mediterranean diet is fructose, other than in small amounts of fruit.
Okay,
and if you look at the true Mediterranean diet with the people of Crete, so that those were the folks that were actually studied. They lived mm-hmm. the longest. They eat a tremendous amount of fruits and vegetables. They eat purslane, which is very high in precursors to EPA and DHA, things that we don't have in our diet. But what they don't eat is high fructose corn syrup. Mm-hmm. And we eat a tremendous amount of high fructose corn syrup in the United States. So I think that it's not just looking at the good things you want to add to your diet, it's really taking an honest look at the things that you're eating that really should not be in the food supply anymore. And high fructose corn syrup is one of them. The other are trans fats. And I know that you, living in New York, an enlightened metropolis, they've actually outlawed the use of trans fats in restaurants in New York City. And they've done that in other cities as well because of the link of trans fats to risk for cardiovascular disease. But trans fats also cause fatty liver disease or are a risk factor for fatty liver disease. So trans fats are things that we get in bakery goods. Mm-hmm. You know, they're processed fats that are semi-solid, like margarine, or certain types of synthetic fats that are used for cooking. Mm-hmm. And they need to be omitted. You know, they need to be taken out of the diet. So I think those are the most important thing. And I get a lot of flack from doctors when I talk about this because they say that the fiber in fruit is a very important part of the diet. And I agree. But there's only 7 grams of fructose in a cup of blueberries or 10 grams of fructose in an apple. That's very different than eating between 50 and as high as 150 grams of fructose, which is what you get from soft drinks. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of foods that are high in either, and I'm going to say a very important word here, either high fructose corn syrup or agave syrup. Organic agave syrup is
that's a trap for a lot of people.
60 to 90% fructose and should not be in the food supply. It is not. There's nothing natural about agave syrup. It's a very synthetic sweetener made out of a starting material from the agave cactus, but then completely perverted into a kind of a synthetic, a natural synthetic form of high fructose corn syrup.
Indeed. So there's some new think about coffee as well when it comes to liver disease, right?
Coffee has an antioxidant in it called chlorogenic acid. And it turns out, when you look at the studies, that people who drink more coffee are less likely to have liver disease. Now, what's interesting about these studies is they didn't differentiate between organic coffee, non-organic coffee. This was just any coffee. Didn't matter whether it was
even decaf. Even decaf.
Yes, decaf, mm-hmm. Nescafe, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Coffee is full of antioxidants. That's been documented in the literature. And we know that drinking coffee does not make liver disease worse. That's also been documented in the literature. The only problem with coffee is that excessive use of coffee, which contains caffeine, can be damaging to the nervous system. Yeah. So, you know, that's the caveat. And so the studies that I've read really show that moderate caffeine intake, or moderate coffee intake, excuse me, of 1 to 2 cups a day has no damaging effect on the liver or longevity. So, yes, coffee is actually, it's the new tea. It's right. Now considered a health food. And, of course,
well, you know, if you wait long enough, everything that's bad turns out to be good for you ultimately. It's like the Woody Allen movie, Sleeper.
I'm waiting for bacon to come around again. It's what? Now on the outs, you know, the New World Health Organization carcinogenicity label on bacon is definitely taking it off people's plates.
Well, I don't pay attention to that. It's the natural non-nitrite bacon that's cured with beets or ascorbic acid or celery works fine for me. So, in terms of supplements, let's get into the supplement arena.
Yes.
First of all, it's any supplement no-nos, because, you know, it's hard for a normal person to go to the health food store. You knock yourself out. You can take pretty much virtually anything. And a normal healthy person is probably not going to come to great harm. But somebody with liver disease really have to watch out, right?
Yes, there are a lot of no-nos, but I'll try and put them into just a few categories.
Sure.
One is iron. Now, if women particularly, and I know this can happen to men too, are iron deficient, you know, blood loss, heavy periods, that's definitely a medical condition and needs to be rectified. It needs, you know, needs to be normalized. But in people who have liver disease, iron, especially excessive iron, can be damaging because it turns into the opposite of an antioxidant in the liver. It turns into a pro-oxidant. So for all, and this is a little bit of a tightrope, but for most liver disease patients, we tell them not to take a multiple vitamin with iron in it unless they have an iron deficiency. And that's easily diagnosed by blood work. Okay. So iron in most healthy people who are not anemic is a no-no. The other no-nos I would specifically say are imported botanical combinations, particularly Ayurvedic combinations from outside the United States, which have been shown to contain high levels of lead, mercury, arsenic, and cadmium. Mm-hmm. Now, that may be on purpose, and it may be because they are taken from plants that are grown in soil that are contaminated. But there's been some very important reports in the medical literature. There was a report in JAMA, actually, looking at the metal contaminant content of these Ayurvedic remedies. So there, it's not that Ayurvedic medicine is bad. It's that if your Ayurvedic medicine is manufactured outside of the United States and imported, it may very likely contain those metals.
Okay.
So I think that's that in general is another area. And, of course, there are, how can I say this, energy-enhancing supplements that may be that may contain drugs, you know, that may be
adulterated.
Contaminated. They're adulterated with pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. In terms of just good old supplements, you know, what is good for you and what can you take? There are very specific number of supplements that have actually been researched with fatty liver disease, as well as hepatitis C, and I'm going to talk about those. Because they are important. And one of my most beloved of supplements, particularly in my hepatitis C patients, but the same is true of fatty liver disease, is vitamin E. Vitamin E is kind of an interesting vitamin in that when they looked at people who had liver damage, and I'm talking about fibrosis, you know, actual serious liver damage, and these were patients who had hepatitis C, who had progressed to NASH. It's another group of individuals who are at high risk for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or individuals with hepatitis C. When they were given just a very moderate dosage of vitamin E, and in my mind, 800 international units is a moderate dose, and they looked at, they actually did liver biopsies in these patients before and after. And it was a very short period of time, 6 months, which, you know, in the liver world, hardly enough time for anything to change, right?
I think it was a trial in New England Journal of Medicine comparing the vitamin E to a drug, Trentel. It was Trentel was a little helpful, but with the vitamin E, it really worked even more effectively.
Well, what was fascinating was that they found out that the vitamin E actually interrupted the genes that were turned on by inflammation that were causing the fibrosis. So vitamin E actually works on a genetic level. My only caveat is that much vitamin E is sourced in a soy oil base. You know, like Eastman Kodak is the manufacturer of most of the vitamin E in the country, and it's in a soy oil base, and that soy, of course, has been genetically modified and contains glyphosate.
Which is a known liver toxin.
A known liver toxin. So there are companies that make vitamin E in an olive oil base. They're getting very smart supplement manufacturers. And vitamin E, as we know, is like the B vitamins. There's a whole family of them. There's not just one vitamin E. There's alpha, gamma, delta, tocopherol, and tocotrienols, and they all work together. So a mixed, it's called a mixed vitamin E or mixed tocopherols is really a more intelligent way to do it. Unfortunately, you know, because this is kind of a new understanding in medicine, there isn't a lot of research done on mixed tocopherols, but in my mind, it makes absolute sense because of the antioxidant effect of those other tocopherols to take a mixed tocopherol. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be at a high dosage. 800 international units is a very safe and very effective dose of vitamin E to take. And it can be very liver protective. Go ahead.
Yeah, can I bring us back to the no-no list? My impression is that niacin and maybe even high-dose niacinamide and vitamin A are not favored if you have liver problems.
Thank you for that. So let's talk about vitamin A first. Vitamin A is a little bit tricky. It depends on who you are. We're finding that patients who have advanced liver disease, and I'm talking about hepatitis C patients who have NASH, hepatitis B patients who have NASH. This is new research that's just come out of Brazil and another country, and I can't remember the name of right now, that these patients are severely vitamin A deficient.
Okay.
But that's progressed liver disease. We know that vitamin A is an important antioxidant in the liver. It's stored in the liver. But if you have liver disease, you may store it inappropriately, and that's the problem, that high-dose vitamin A. So, you know, here we're talking about over 50,000 international units a day, may be problematic, and that's a maybe problematic. So that's a potential problem. And as far as what was the other nutrient that you mentioned?
Niacin high-dose niacinamide?
So we know that high-dose niacinamide can cause elevation of liver enzymes. In patients who have liver disease, they're more at risk for that elevation of liver enzymes. So if someone is taking high-dose niacin for their blood lipids, and they have concomitant liver disease, that can be problematic as well.
Okay. So coming back to the good things.
Back to the good list. So number two on the good list would be magnesium. So we know that half of our population in America is deficient in magnesium, doesn't get enough in their food or from the multiple vitamin that they take if they take one. Magnesium is really important in fatty liver disease. People who have fatty liver disease are more prone to deficiencies of magnesium. Magnesium is very important in the normal working of the liver, you know, in terms of the system in the liver that detoxifies pharmaceuticals and hormones. And even though there have not been any specific studies looking at giving magnesium to people with fatty liver disease, it is clear that magnesium acts as an antioxidant in the liver. That's been established. And so it is not harmful.
I think they just, apropos of magnesium, I think they just came up with a study that suggests it may work similarly against pancreatic cancer. It was a big surprise because, okay, it's not an antioxidant, but I guess it helps to process some of the accumulated toxins and maybe accelerates their elimination.
That's correct. Environmental pollutants cannot be detoxified in the liver without sufficient magnesium.
Okay.
It's very important in those enzyme systems. So magnesium, there are a whole variety of types of magnesium. The less absorbable forms are like magnesium oxide. You know, that's a standard form that's described. The more absorbable forms are citrate, glycinate, malate. Those are highly absorbable forms.
Taurate, and maybe taurine also has some specific liver magnesium benefits as an individual amino acid.
And too much magnesium will cause diarrhea. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting to me in my clinical practice that for my magnesium deficient patients, some of them have to take 1,000 milligrams to 2,000 milligrams a day in order to reach sufficiency. Now, I think, you know, those are exceptional patients. Most patients do well on 500 or 800 milligrams of magnesium a day.
But it turns out that side effect of magnesium actually may be beneficial because obviously constipation is a risk factor for liver problems. You keep the toxins inside. And, you know, we know from even treating hospital patients that one of the treatments for patients with advanced cirrhosis is to give them a powerful laxative called lactulose, cleans them out, and their symptoms abate.
Absolutely. Yeah, lactulose actually improves the gut microbiome. Mm-hmm. I was fascinated to learn it's actually a good drug. So it's one of the pharmaceuticals.
We just thought it was a laxative, but it actually works on the microbiome.
Yeah, it is great. Mm-hmm. So number three is vitamin D.
Okay.
No surprise, right? That the majority of patients with fatty liver disease are vitamin D deficient. We know that vitamin D is very important in the workings of the immune system, that it actually has an antioxidant effect in the liver, and that it's anti-inflammatory. And I'm talking specifically about inflammation in the liver as an organ. So vitamin D depends on it depends on your own individual levels of vitamin D, how much you need, and that's something that can be calculated, but it does necessitate understanding and knowing what your vitamin D, your blood 25 hydroxy vitamin D levels are. But vitamin D has been studied in fatty liver disease and found not only to be deficient, but helpful. The other group that's vitamin D deficient are patients with hepatitis C, and they do much better when their vitamin D levels are normalized. They actually do better on treatment. They're more likely to respond to treatment if their vitamin D levels are normal. So vitamin D is very important. And then I think in terms of other supplements, probiotics are something that you've mentioned. And that's certainly, you know, I don't mean to put probiotics anywhere near the bottom of the list, because they are so crucial in the treatment of fatty liver disease. There have been, I would say, probably about 40 to 50 studies looking at using probiotics in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And I'll tell you a brief story. I was at the liver conference. There's a big liver conference in Boston every year called the AASLD. And I was there, and this was many years ago, probably 10 years ago, and there was a hepatologist there, Anna May Deal, who is well known globally for her work in liver disease, and she had presented some data in animals showing that probiotics could reverse fatty liver disease, completely reverse it and take it away. And so I met her at one of the researchers' meetings, and I went up to her and I said, "Why aren't you doing this in humans?" And she looked at me with an exasperated look, and she said, "Because the FDA won't let us."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was back in the days when it was – it's different now, but that was back in the days, a whole decade ago, when it was difficult to get an investigative drug number for a probiotic.
Wow.
Since then, there have been many studies looking at treating – non-alcoholic fatty liver disease with probiotics, and you might wonder what type of probiotic, but it's good old lactobacillus bifidobacteria, streptococci, combination, VSL3. You know, it's nothing secret. Mm-hmm. It's not anything you need a prescription for. But what they found was that in these trials, not only did liver enzymes go down, but they actually saw an improvement in the microbiome, improvement in SIBO, because SIBO is a big problem in people with fatty liver
disease. Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, right. We think it's present in about 50% of people with fatty liver disease, which is an epidemic inside of an epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
But probiotics actually, in some small trials, improved liver biopsies, and that's the gold standard. If you can improve a liver biopsy in somebody with fatty liver disease, you know that you're getting to the very root of the problem. And that makes us think that the root of the problem may be in the gut, maybe the microbiome affecting the immune system and the functioning of the intestinal tract and the immune system inside of it.
How about some of the other traditional liver nutrients, things like choline, NAC or N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid?
Yes.
Any basis for believing those could be helpful?
Yes, absolutely. There have been some good studies with N-acetylcysteine in animal models. We're not to the point where we have really big human trials, but N-acetylcysteine is a very potent antioxidant, preserves our own glutathione, which is our own, you know, all mammals have glutathione. It's what we've evolved to be able to deal with. You know, we developed glutathione back in the volcano days when the dinosaurs were around. And it is our own antioxidant that we make. And N-acetylcysteine preserves it, makes it more of it.
It actually is an antidote for a Tylenol toxicity. If you take too much Tylenol, you will actually need a liver transplant unless you take – they literally put a funnel in your mouth and administer Tylenol via a nasogastric tube.
Right, to keep you around.
Yep.
Yes, N-acetylcysteine is also used as an inhalant in severe bronchitis to bring up very thick mucus. And mm-hmm. so it actually thins the mucus lining.
Mucomist, they call it.
Mucomist, yeah, I've used it. It's wonderful. So N-acetylcysteine available over the counter. The studies show that about 1,500 milligrams a day is helpful. The only people who cannot take N-acetylcysteine are people who have active ulcers because it okay. does thin the mucus lining of the stomach and can cause an exacerbation or worsening of the ulcer.
That's a good pearl. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The other interesting study that I'll bring up is on green tea.
Yes.
There was a very interesting study that was published just last year giving patients with the progressed form of fatty liver, NASH, you know, the progressed form where you've got cirrhosis and are at risk for liver cancer and end-stage liver disease, giving them the equivalent, and I was going to look this up before the show, but 600 milligrams I think is the equivalent of about 4 cups of tea, mm-hmm. if I'm remembering correctly, 4 to 6 cups of tea. So a fair amount of green tea. But what they saw was not only did their liver enzymes go down, but they actually, in a few of them, had improvements in their liver biopsies in a very short period of time.
That confuses me a little bit, because when you look at things that they tell you not to take if you have liver problems, like advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, mm-hmm. they say don't take EGCG, because there's actually some studies that say that EGCG, the concentrate in the pill, is toxic if you have for normal people it's fine, but if you have very advanced liver disease, stay away from that. Yet you say drinking the green tea is beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering if that was an animal model. This was done in humans who had NASH. It was a Japanese study. They were given 600 milligrams of green tea catechins in a pill.
Okay.
They were followed for 3 to 6 months, and there was no elevation of liver enzymes, which is
better.
What we would expect in that situation, right?
That's very
reassuring. Not only did their CRP, which is an indication of inflammation, go down dramatically, but on a scan where they looked at the fat in the liver to the fat in the spleen, which is almost as good as a biopsy, that actually improved significantly. And other markers of active fibrosis went down. So I was given this by a colleague who said, could you please comment on this? This is a pretty interesting study. It was a pilot, needs to be repeated, you know, in bigger, you know, groups of people. But it's not the first study in humans to look at the effect of green tea and fatty liver disease. So I'm wondering, you know, if the research you're referring to was done in a rat model or a mouse model, and what, you know, what they actually did to look at worsening or improvement of the liver disease. Because a lot of times in animal model research, you can't extrapolate to humans just because, you know, rats don't have gallbladders.
Right.
So they're a little bit different than we are.
Unfortunately, the powers that be have seized upon that as a way to impugn EGCG and say that it's bad for the liver. I've seen it in terms of clinical recommendations for patients with liver disease, avoid EGCG. But it turns out there's another side to that story.
I will send you this article, and there are a couple of other articles in the references that of the same type, you know, done in humans.
Well, I've always taken that with a little bit of a grain of salt, and generally found that it's safe to prescribe moderate amounts of EGCG to patients with liver disease. It may be even beneficial. So, okay, you've listed a real comprehensive compendium of things that people can do to avert or reverse liver disease. What's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? Where can people find additional resources about you, about progressivemedicaleducation.com? And also, it's my impression that there's a book that's available at no cost via hepcchallenge.org.
Yes. So one of the things that our group did for public education was we wrote a book called Choices, which is written for people with hepatitis C so that they can look at the diversity of therapies that are out there. It was written by myself, 3 research hepatologists who are well known in the United States, who are very conservative, by the way. It was a very interesting partnership we had. Respectful, even in our disagreement. But it also includes things like Ayurvedic medicine and acupuncture and Chinese medicine. And it's all referenced, and it's available at the HepCChallenge.org website, which is the Hepatitis C Ambassador's website. So it's updated on a regular basis, it's downloadable, and it's free of charge.
HepCChallenge.org.
Correct.
Okay.
And what I have done in this arena in terms of education is I have a course. Now, this course is for healthcare providers. It was originally for some acupuncturists and naturopathic physicians, but it's also available to the public in integrative hepatology, and that's available at progressivemedicine.org. It's unfortunately not free because we have to eat, but
right.
But it is available.
Progressivemedicine.org?
Progressivemedicaleducation.org
is the website. PME.org. So Progressive Medical Education.
ProgressiveMedicalEducation.org.
Very
good. PME was already taken, so we couldn't use it.
But I'm sure.
Progressive Medical Education was not. So it's unfortunately long, but it is the name of the educational organization that I work with.
Okay. And your practice for...
So I am currently, I wanted to correct you, I am currently not in practice.
Oh, okay.
Do some consulting, but I have gone completely into education because the ripples go out further into the pond that way, I find.
Yep.
So I am available through progressivemedicaleducation.org.
Okay, but not for individual consultation, but you're an educational resource.
Yeah, I do consult with physicians, specifically in advanced liver disease, but no longer available to patients. But my education is available. You can just YouTube me, and you'll come up with all kinds of content on YouTube.
Well, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you so much for a very careful and comprehensive dissertation on a subject that is of utmost importance and also often ignored because we are in the midst of an epidemic of liver problems, and many people will succumb to this silent epidemic if we don't identify it early and curtail it. So thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Ron.
That was Dr. Lynn Patrick. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us, Lynn, and listeners. And this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.